All right, so I want to start off with a news story that we forgot to mention last week. Apparently, in the new version of Chrome OS that's coming out, version 59, I think, 59?
Yeah, 59.
Which has reached the stable channel, they are going to add printing natively without having to go through Google Cloud Printer. And I kind of like this idea.
Yeah, I do too. I mean, the feature was always there, kind of hidden as part of the Linux kernel and whatnot. But being they're exposing a lot more functionality, like connecting to Samba shares and whatnot, it only makes sense for them to make the OS more mature.
And it says that you're going to have to use your printer's IP address to make things work, which is great because that's how all we have is network printers. And so I just wonder if this is actually going to come to the enterprise version of Chrome OS, as opposed to basically let it be something that we can control in the admin console like we can the cloud printing.
Yeah, it'd be very handy if they do, and especially if they don't expose it to only certain accounts like they do with the Google Cloud Print right now.
Because cloud printing, I just really don't like it. I mean, when it works, it's great, but when it doesn't work, it's a disaster.
Yeah, and there's no real troubleshooting steps with it. It's like, okay, I restarted the Cloud Print services, so let's go see if they came back online. Oh, crap, now there's two of everything.
Yeah, and so you have to, like, uninstall the Print Sync tool or whatever, and then clear out all the printers, and you can't do it all at once. You have to do them all manually, all one at a time. And then you have to reinstall the thing and resync the printers. I've already done this, like, twice.
I know, and then you got to reshare them because they all have new GUIDs.
And then you got to make sure that you're logged into the admin console with the account that you signed into the sync tool with so that you could actually push the printers out. Because if you're logged into with another admin account, like I know I break the rule and my account's an admin account, but because it's just convenient and I know that that's wrong. But I want to be able to log in and push out the printers, but I can't because I can't see them because they're not quote-unquote owned by me.
Yeah, I have a separate service account that I do, like, syncing and the printers and stuff with it. But it just boggles my mind how Google, with all the infinite resources they have, managed to screw up printing.
Something that's been around since forever.
The 70s. I mean, goodness. I mean, heck, what they're using to do the native print is just LPR, line printers. It's just a network printer port from, like, 1972.
I just really hope that they open that up, that we can start adding in local printers.
You know, maybe they'll create an API where there can be like a Google Apps add-on or something where we can do it through there at the very least.
But I guess we'll see. I haven't checked any Chromebooks lately. Been a little busy imaging Windows machines to see if anything's been updated to...
Well, you know what? Hold on. I don't know what version. Let's look real quick. I know we're on the fly right now. But what version Chrome OS is this thing running? All right, so I am on version 60.
Oh, so you should at least have some of the printing stuff.
Hey, printers. Yep, there it is. Printers. Add printer. And it does an auto search, or you can click add manually, and it supports IPP, IPPS, HTT printers, HTTPS printers, app sockets, and then the old LPD printer. So, yeah, it's all here.
Great. I guess now we just need to wait for the admin console to update and maybe give us this
feature.
Yeah.
That's cool. So I guess not only did I get an Android update a few minutes ago, I also got the printer support.
There you go. Actually, you might have got the printer support last week when your thing updated.
And took, like, forever?
Yeah.
It seems to only want to update right before we record.
That's usually how life goes. Like your air conditioner breaking on Father's Day and your birthday.
Yeah, but you know what? It's all good now. We're cool. We only had to stay one night at the in-laws.
Should I cut that or not?
No, that's okay. They weren't there.
But you have some news that you wanted to mention, too, that something new's coming out.
Yeah, it actually came out this week. I'm a huge open source fan, Linux and whatnot. Debian, which is a real stable, slow-releasing distribution, in which a lot of distributions are built off of, Ubuntu included, released version 9, Stretch. And being Ian Murdoch, one of the founders of Debian, passed away last year. It's dedicated to him, so it's kind of a good release. Lots of modern things added into it. But they still are shoving systemd down our throats, so we will like it.
And what is systemd?
Systemd is a overall system layer that does things like control, network stack, services, and even can go into like the display layer with Wayland, it's kind of meant to unify all management under one big thing. Where before it was Ubuntu, Debian, and whatnot, they were using, you probably have seen the init.d folder.
Yes.
Which was like System 5 scripts, which is a really old method of doing things. System D can actually check the state of things before it tries to do task. And it also lets you execute in parallel, so you don't have to wait for things to finish. So it does increase your boot time and whatnot, but it changed management drastically.
I see. So is Debian the flavor of Linux you like to use?
I do like to use Debian. I do prefer it for our servers and whatnot, but there are some products where I just can't. I'll test our camera system later on Debian 9, but it likes Ubuntu. Just because some of the packages that are in the repository, like the JDK 8,
yeah, good old job.
They're not as conservative as Debian as far as updates.
I haven't really messed with Debian. I need to install it in the VM and see like really what's different between that and Ubuntu. I assume it's probably not too much, but
it won't be purple.
But I do like the purple.
And by default, your bash won't be color-coded.
Oh, that's my favorite thing about Ubuntu.
Yeah, I mean, Ubuntu takes Debian and does some really nice things to it, but Debian overall is more stable. They're a conservative release.
But speaking of releases and server OSs, Microsoft announced that they are going to start doing basically Windows as a service for Windows Server. And that's kind of what I want to talk about today as far as our topic, is I want to talk about Microsoft's new upgrade cycles with Windows 10 and Windows Server. Obviously, Windows 10 started it back earlier this year, I suppose, whenever they started coming out with Windows 10. Or maybe it was last year, I guess, Windows 10. With the Creators Update, the Anniversary Update, the soon-to-be Fall Creators Update.
Yes, because we've already stopped getting creative with names.
Yeah, so we're just going to just add the season at which we're going to release. So if this year's creators, next year maybe Workstation or whatever, since we talked about Workstation last week, it'll get Fall Workstation release, I guess.
Yeah, I think they should just go the numbers route like Ubuntu did.
So can you explain to me what they actually mean by Windows as a service?
Well, what they're trying to do as far as a service is they're trying to break the operating system up into components that can be more easily updated. You know, it's not like the services that we're used to, like we pay for a subscription to something and then we get the latest version of that, kind of like Office 365. They're not there yet with Windows 10. I know they will be soon, but they're not. So they're more like developing the underpinnings to get it to that point where you'll buy Windows. And just like now how your Windows 10 activation is tied to your Microsoft account, well, your Microsoft account says, hey, this guy has Windows. So it'll just automatically get you the latest edition of it. That's the end goal. They're building all those underpinnings right now where they can release new features and fixes and all that faster and more predictability about how the installations will go and what could possibly go wrong so they can fix things.
So will you buy Windows or will you subscribe to Windows and pay monthly like Office 365? Well, we have a Windows 365 account that we can sign up for now.
I don't know how they're going to go about that, because the second they pull the trigger as far as the subscription model, there's going to be a huge knee-jerk reaction between their customer base and them, because a lot of customers don't want subscription models.
I think if they're going to do it, I think they need to wait for whatever's next. Like if they do Windows 12 or 11, because we know we skip odd numbers apparently.
No, we had 7, we had 8, we had 9, which was actually 8.1. We'll go ahead and give them that. Which still had version number 7, and actually it was 6-something in the command prompt, which is weird. We'll get in, yeah, whatever, yeah. Microsoft, you can't count.
But needless to say, whatever they do next, the next version of Windows, I think if they're going to do it, they need to wait for that. Or they should have went to the subscription model when they went to Windows 10. They gave Windows 10 away for free for a year, which was I think was a great move. But after a year later, they could have started the subscription model. Hey, you could sign up now and get it for free, or we're going to start doing them. But I can't. But if you're going to do the updates, you can't really do the subscription model after that. So that's why I think they might need to wait for the next release, because, okay, hey, we're going to skip to this. You can pay $120 up front for the OS, or $140 because, you know, whatever Windows is, or you can pay $5 to $10 a month. Now, people may balk at the subscription fee, but if they, like, calculate it out, I mean, if they release a new version every year, which, I mean, they're going to get two new builds. Do we really consider the builds versions, or just...
Well, the builds are versions. I mean, that's actually part of the version number. Now, they did, you know, gave me an idea. They've already fixed this problem, and we just didn't realize it. You know, when they went to one core for Windows, they fixed the problem. The underlying OS is one core under all the versions. The features are just on top of that. So you can still get all your security fixes and whatnot to the core, but just not new features. I can see that being the model that they do with the subscription and the non-subscribers.
Oh, so like when your initial Windows 10 install or whatever, you'll continue to get the security updates or whatever, but at some point if you want all the new features, you're going to have to either subscribe or, well, basically you'll have to subscribe.
Yeah, because actually Windows One Core, that's actually the real name of it, One Core. I guess we'll... Since we got one drive, one core, Xbox One, everybody's got to be one. So we only have one version, so it's one core. But from Windows IoT to Xbox to HoloLens to Windows Server to Windows 10 to even Windows Phone, they all run the same core.
So how do you feel about like the subscription model in general? Do you think it would work for this kind of operating system or whatever?
I think it could work for the consumer level real easily, because I hate to say it like this, but consumers really aren't the bread and butter of Microsoft. It's kind of the test area. But I'm not sure how enterprise customers are going to respond to this, because Windows 7 is still the predominant operating system in enterprise. It's old.
Yes.
I mean, enterprises, we tend to hang on to old software the longest because... Well, we know it in and out. We know how to maintain it and keep it running.
And a lot of times we have old stuff that we can't run on the newer platforms that we have to. I mean, we talked about that when we talked about the ransomware stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how well the enterprise customers are going to respond to it. I mean, now, if they include it as part of like the Enterprise Plus versions of Office 365, I don't see it really being a big deal. And those that are in education that do like school enrollments, it'll be a non-issue for them too.
School agreements are essentially a subscription model anyway.
Yeah, and it'll be a non-issue to them, of course. Now, the update cycles and whatnot to that, of course, will come into concern, but if the way they got the updates going now with Windows 10 and One Core, they're kind of a non-issue.
Okay, so you've been running Windows 10 for the past year or so, right, at your school?
Actually, I've been running it since before the start menu was how it is. I was running it as part of the Insider program long ago.
Oh, great. Okay, so you might can answer these questions for me, because I'm just starting my rollout, and I'm starting with the Creators update because it was the latest or whatever.
That's a great one to start with.
I like it. So... what am I going to experience in 6 months? Like, how do you handle, like, the upgrade path to, like, how did you go from Anniversary to Creators or from the original Windows 10 to Anniversary Edition?
Well, it actually, if you've gone into your WSUS server, you'll notice that it becomes a new product in there. So you do, I see it being held back until administrators add it to their upgrade paths as far as WSUS. But it does come in there, like when Microsoft announced Windows 10 LTS. About 2 weeks later, it showed up as an option in our WSUS servers to download updates for that. So I imagine, just like it'll behave as any other update, if you have it as a source, if you have it as a product that you support in your WSUS, it'll be made available to those machines to update, and whether you have approved those updates or not is where it gets installed. Because they do have the features version, the features type of update you can pick in there. So you can actually hold features down if you want, but I imagine they'll classify these next builds as features. that would make sense to me, being the cores are all the same.
And so, like, if I want to push out, say, the Fall Creators Update whenever it eventually drops for us to get, it always seems like it comes out for consumers first. But like you said, that's their test market, mm-hmm. and then they see how that goes, and then they'll release it to the volume subscribers or whatever. And so I'll just go into the WSUS server and just click the box. And
yeah, we'll hit approve, and it'll go. And then your network will vomit on itself as it goes and pushes that 10 gig to everybody.
And I know, I mean, I've had Windows 10 on my virtual machine, on my Mac. And so, and I started with, like, the Windows 10. I've done the anniversary update, and I did the creators update or whatever, all those different installs. But what I notice is it always leaves the previous version of Windows installed as a way to roll back.
It does.
Now, and that, does that ever...
That takes up a lot of space.
Yes. How do you handle that? Is that something you have to, like, manually clear out, or...
Yep, it's disk. It has to be done through disk cleanup.
That's not something I really want to hear.
No, you can script it out, of course, if you want, but it is something that has to be done, and it's there as a failsafe because, gosh, what was it, years ago when Server 2003 R2 came out, they had, it wasn't R2, I think it was actually, it was Windows 2000, man, I'm getting old, it was Windows 2000, it was when Service Pack 3 came out. When Service Pack 3 installed, it broke Symantec Backup Exec everywhere. And in order to get it working again, we had to roll back the service pack install. And I think that's why they're so conservative with things like that, is for those products that don't update that we tend to hang on to. No, I'm not using Symantec Backup Exec, anyone. Never, ever, ever again.
That used to be the big thing, man. It was, well, it used to be something, and didn't Symantec buy it?
Yeah, they bought it from the Norton company.
Yeah, it's just, it was pretty bad.
Yeah. Old Norton with his glasses on the front of every box.
But you know, though, it's one of those things like Google Cloud Printing, though. Like, if you could actually get it set up and get it working, it actually worked well. But when it broke, that's when the world just kind of cratered.
Yeah, and Cloud Print's a great example of that because it does randomly just break.
I mean, but speaking of Windows Server Update or whatever, that breaks every once in a while, too.
Yeah, it does. At least... we didn't get to our servers that bad insider update that pushed out to everybody a couple weeks ago.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Whew, that one was a bad one. That, like, bricked devices.
So, do you have your devices enrolled in the insider?
I do not. I used to. When I carried a Windows phone around, I ran it on the fast ring. But I do keep a VM on it, just so I can play with some of the new stuff.
Okay, because I don't have anything, like, registered for insider programs from Microsoft.
It was. I'm funny about my desktop. I want it to work. And having to reload it is just not convenient. So I just don't want to. I just want to run the insider on my main machine.
Not only wanting it to work, you need it to work. I mean,
I do need it
to
work.
And that's why we had this conversation offline where we were talking about how it's taking a lot out of me not to install the macOS beta of High Sierra or whatever because I want to try out those new features. But it's like, I told you, it's like I have to have my laptop to work.
Yeah. I mean, if it breaks, it takes us down for a day. And heaven help us if something catastrophic happens during that day.
Exactly. And that's why I ran the iOS 11 beta on my iPad for about a couple hours just so I could see it because it's not a mission-critical device for me. But there was no way that thing's going on my phone. I mean, when we get to the public beta stage, maybe in like public beta 2 or 3, I might do it because if they're going to release a public beta, it's got to be a little bit stable.
Yeah, I can tell you when I ran the Windows, I had a Lumia 950. When I ran it on the fast ring, I did a device recovery about once a week. It broke a lot, a whole lot, but it was my fault. I knew it was going to. It was the fast ring.
But even then, I'm always leery about doing... I don't even do the insider track for Office on my Mac. Because, like, when you set up the updates or whatever, you can, like, pick, enjoy the insider channel. And I'm like, I don't even do that because there's been times even, like, on the stable channel, I guess you would call it, of Microsoft updates, they'll release an update that just borks everything.
Yeah, it's one of those, how did that make it through testing? Did y'all not have anything else installed on this machine but Office?
I mean... come on. And so I'm always real leery. especially when it comes to my stuff. When it comes to student machines, I don't care.
Well, heck, you just you create new home directories for them every summer anyway.
That's right. Yeah, we just wipe them out and start over. That's how we move home directories for students. We just delete them and recreate them.
Well, I mean, I think this is going to – it'll work in Microsoft's favor in the end, and hopefully it'll work in our favor in the end, being they have the peer-to-peer updates between the clients, so it won't be quite as heavily reliant on our single point of failure WSUS servers. Because when every client can deploy updates to every other client, I mean, that can save a lot of network traffic.
Yeah, I need to find a way that maybe I can enable that with group policy, because I don't think I have that enabled. I think I use the education version of Windows 10, and that's not even enabled by default, I don't think.
Yeah, I'd roll the Windows 10 Pro out here, because I don't have the school agreement.
Yeah, and that's something new that we got this year, and so that's really the only reason why I did it, because I didn't want Facebook and Twitter installing themselves on my student desktop machine. So,
oh, come on. Everybody needs Candy Crush Soda Saga.
Dude, when that happened, when I was setting up this image and Candy Crush installed, I said, okay, this isn't going to work. I was tempted just to scrap the whole idea at that point.
That's when you go, you're like, hey, Cortana, don't do dumb stuff.
That was just, that blew my mind when Candy Crush self-installed. I mean, I get it. I mean, Candy Crush probably paid Microsoft a lot of money to actually do that, but.
Well, and it was one of 10 apps in the store anyway, so I mean.
That's true. But let's roll back a little bit. I did want to kind of mention this about the how we talked about maybe Windows moving towards more of a subscription model. On the flip side of that, here's the fanboy coming out in me. When you purchase an Apple computer, you get the OS that it comes with, whatever version of macOS comes on it. And then, past few years, everything has been a free upgrade to anything that can run it. Do you see Microsoft moving to a subscription service, or do you see Microsoft trying to be more Apple-y in the fact that you buy your OS and then you get the free upgrades as long as your computer can handle it?
Well, I mean, they're two very different companies. I mean, Microsoft is a software company where Apple is a hardware company. And you have to look at how Apple is giving the OS away, but they also only support one version down. So if your computer can't run the latest, well, by golly, you're going to have to get a new computer within another year, because you won't be able to update or run anything after that happens.
Yeah, we'll still get patches released every once in a while for older releases, but I mean, it has to be like a really critical bug that needs to be locked down in order for Apple to actually push out the patch for it.
Now, I know I ran into this a couple months ago, and I found it really irritating. What are we on, version 10.12 right now on OS 10?
10.12, yes.
10.12? I had a machine running 10.11. I couldn't run Apple Configurator.
Yeah, they do kind of, with some of their newer apps, they do kind of lock down some restrictions on the OS that it needs to run.
Now, bless this poor laptop's heart, I did upgrade it to 10.12, and it's an old Core 2 Duo.
I'm sure it loved that.
All it can do is run Apple Configurator, because nothing else will run.
I have an old one too, but it's at least got a Core i5 in it, so it runs pretty well.
Yeah, this thing is, oh man, it's a late 2010. So, yeah, it's had a good life. And no, it probably shouldn't be running the latest edition, but I guess into Apple's fairness, they did let it install.
Yeah, they could always tell you no.
Yeah.
But, okay, so with Windows 10, Microsoft brought this new upgrade cycle. We mentioned the long-term service branch, the LTSB, and now we get twice yearly updates, I guess, to new versions of Windows. And they announced today, or actually earlier this week, a few days ago, that they're actually bringing this idea of updates to server. And since we're kind of enterprise guys, we deal more with the server side of things than we do the client side of things, just on the things that we do. How is this going to work for like server OSs? I mean, obviously they're not bringing it to all of the builds.
No, and from reading Microsoft's documentation and whatnot, and first off, I just got to say kudos to Microsoft. They managed to rename a product that isn't even a year old already. You know, we had the LTSB, like you just said. the long-term servicing branch. Well, apparently they've already renamed it to the long-term servicing channel. So it's LTSC now. Oh, go Microsoft. But it looks like what they're going to be doing is those editions of server that have the GUI installed on them are going to be held back. They're not going to be on the semi-annual releases. And it looks like Server Core, Server Nano, those ones that they really push in the virtualized environments are the ones that are going to be rolling much quicker, which makes sense.
I mean,
if you have those old legacy applications, generally they have to be installed within a server environment that has a GUI, just because that's how everybody in the past has dealt with Microsoft as a GUI application.
Yeah, so when did they bring out Server Core? And Server Core is basically just... to me, it reminds me of going back to the old DOS days, where it's just kind of the back-end version of Windows running, like you said, without the GUI. Did they start that with 2012? Because I think I remember seeing that as part of like the install version.
Actually, I'm pulling it up right now. Server Core actually came available in Windows Server 2008, not even R2.
Oh. A long time
yeah,
ago.
And it did. And it was a long time ago. I didn't realize it was that long ago, but they had it. They had a really locked down feature set that it was available to do. And granted, it didn't make a lot of sense in 2008 and 2008 R2 because they didn't have that all encompassing server manager yet. So maybe that's why we didn't really notice until 2012.
So what kind of things can you run on Server Core?
Well, anything that doesn't require a GUI.
Well, to be honest, that's, I mean, really, with the server manager application that they came out with for 2012 or whatever, basically nothing needs to run in a GUI anymore.
Well, and honestly, all of the Microsoft services that are in the add remove roles are available on Server Core. Not Server Nano, but Server Core they are.
And so what does Server Nano get you?
Server Nano is a really stripped-down version of Server that you actually have to pre-build images for, and what it's meant to do is run Windows containers. It's kind of like the host environment for containers.
Oh, I see. Sweet.
When they talk about there are two different types of Windows containers. There's, well, the one called Windows containers, which runs atop the underlying OS that it's running on, and then there's Hyper-V containers, which runs atop of Nano in a container. So it's one provides more isolation than the other.
So are you running either of those in your environment, either Core or Nano?
I do have one Nano instance just to test some things with.
Okay. So you're not doing any Cores?
I do not have any Core installs. I didn't know. And mainly it's been out of sheer laziness because In the extreme situation where something chaotic goes on, I kind of like a GUI.
Yeah, you know, and that's kind of my thinking too. I love the new Server Manager application. Being able to add roles and everything just from one workstation or whatever without having to like remote into that computer or this server or that server, that's really handy. I really enjoy it. I really like it. But like you said, when things go wrong, I mean, sometimes we have to, like, open up the remote console from the virtualization environment and basically use a keyboard and mouse straight onto the server, and a lot of times we need a GUI for things.
Yeah, and one of the hypervisors I run, I am running Hyper-V server, which is basically a Server Core install. Doesn't have any kind of GUI or whatnot. It just kind of launches into a PowerShell instance. You can do all the features in there, and it's just all done through PowerShell. But PowerShell just doesn't have a really good help section, kind of like the man pages in Linux. It just doesn't have that counterpart, so you really are kind of left fumbling of what command parameters to use unless you know them.
Yeah, and I'm just really starting to get into some PowerShell. It's a pretty powerful scripting language. I mean, it can do all sorts of stuff. I mean, the latest thing I did was I changed, when I stood up new domain controllers, I was able to change the static DNS servers of all of my servers with one command. And yeah, that was like and normally I would just remote in, right click properties, IPv4 settings, type in the new IP addresses, but with right click run as admin or whatever, I was like, boom, done.
Yeah, well, I mean, in Server Core it is managed, it is meant to be managed with PowerShell and WinRM through all the remote utilities they have, and of course it's a big selling point for System Center. It does a lot of those stuff a lot easier.
So are we going to be standing up our next domain controllers in Windows Core?
I don't see a problem with it. I mean, the attack surface would be decreased tremendously about which things you'd have to keep patching. That, and there is a zero chance of Adobe Flash running on it.
And though, when you do anything in Active Directory, how many times are you actually on the domain controller server itself anyway?
Never. Never. So, I mean, it's just there in case I need it. Everything is still done remotely, and not even through terminal services. It's just done remotely through WinRM.
Yeah, most of the time I am either on my virtual machine using the server manager to connect to Active Directory and all that other stuff, or the administrative features or whatever, or I VNC into a desktop that I have in my office that is specifically set up to do those sorts of tasks.
Yeah, and I guess Microsoft moving this direction with everything, it wasn't just because, well, Linux doesn't have a GUI. We don't have to have a GUI. It was, well, let's architect our infrastructures where the underlying OS is less relevant, to where those services can be more fluid across whatever. That way the upgrade cycles can be painless.
Okay, so what kind of impacts are we going to see with this new release cycle with server? Obviously, it's going to be more updates.
It's going to be more updates. We're going to have to check WSUS a lot more often, or at least during those times of the year when they do their release cycles. And you'll have to make sure that if you do fall into one of those service channels that are only on the 18-month cycle, that you do upgrade those servers. You don't let them sit.
Yeah, because I'm guessing with these new upgrade cycles or whatever, that also means that support is not going to, I guess, like you said, the 18 months, you're not going to have updates as long as you normally would with these new release cycles.
No, I mean, I can see them doing things to like the one core as far as kernel level security updates, kind of like what they did a couple weeks ago with Windows XP. They threw an update its way.
Yeah, I know. I saw that. I was really surprised.
Yeah, I think it was a mistake, but neither here nor there. They did it.
But you know what? They got themselves. I mean, we're dealing with it with XP. In a few years, we're going to be dealing the same thing with Windows 7.
Yeah, and I think it's going to be a lot harder with Windows 7 because Windows 7 is actually a really great operating system.
It is. I mean, I was a real big fan of Windows 7, I mean, for a while, and then 8 sort of just came and murdered it. Any good feelings I had towards Windows 8 kind of ruined them.
Man, 8 was a weird time. That, bless their hearts. I mean, that was just one botched decision after another.
8.1 made things a little bit better, but...
Yeah, I ran server 12 here, not even R2. After I left 12, I went straight to 16. And it blew my mind that I had to go to the bottom corner of my server to get the menu to pop up, or to the top right corner to get the stinking charm bar to pop up so I could do things. Because, no, the keyboard shortcuts wouldn't work through remote desktop. It'd fire up my desktops.
I was lucky enough. I moved when we moved from 2003 R2. We moved to 2008 R2, and then I moved to 2012 R2. And so,
you know, R2 jumps are very safe.
R2, I really like R2, but this time I've gone from 2012 R2 to straight into 2016. I didn't wait for R2, but based on this Microsoft documentation, I feel a little bit better about it because they told me that it's going to last for 2 to 3 years. So.
Yeah, and 16 really is a good OS. They completed a lot of that, the cloud OS piece of their infrastructure with it.
I'm really digging how, I mean, things just seem to be easier in it too. I don't really know how any other way to explain it, but I mean, just the way that they do the roles and the feature set now with this server manager tool, it just, to me, it seems a lot easier to actually get things done.
The only beef that I have, and please, Microsoft, please fix this. I do not like to have to run dism commands to install .NET 3.5.
Yeah, that is kind of... But you've had that even with Windows 10, and I think in 8 you had to do it from add remove features.
I know. I'm just sick of doing it. If I have it in my WSUS server, just use the source like you do everything else.
In fact, I had to... I had to do a group policy that actually told the computers, the clients, to actually, when I needed to install that, that I had to go to WSUS to install it because it was really weird. It was like some kind of setting I had to do to actually get that to work. But on the flip side of that, every time I plug in a new mouse and keyboard, it wants to go check WSUS for drivers first. And so it takes like 12 times longer than what it should be to make a mouse work.
Be like, I see you've installed a Microsoft keyboard. Would you like me to install IntelliSense for you?
Oh, man, I remember IntelliSense, IntelliPoint, and IntelliTouch.
Yes. I don't know what Intelli was any kind of intelligent about it. It was just a stinking keyboard with volume controls.
Yeah, it's crazy. But you had that cool ergonomic one.
Yeah, the one that, like, folded up, too.
Yeah, and then apparently they came out with a new ergonomic one that people hate, and so they stockpiled on the old one for when they break.
That's funny. I actually had one of those old ones that you basically, it felt like you were typing on a globe there.
Yeah, that's the one I'm talking about. People are stock, when they can get them, they stockpile them. They'll buy like three or four of them.
Oh, dude, they are fantastic keyboards.
Because the new ones that they came out with aren't very good.
No, they went from a convex to a concave. I don't know how ergonomic it is twisting the other direction, but whatever.
Yeah.
They're smarter than me.
They probably have the trackballs, too, in their closets stockpiled.
Oh, good Lord. Yeah, that was something I never could use. I have no idea what I'm doing.
Yeah, that and the little thing in the middle of the Dell and Lenovo laptops. The little thing in the middle of the keyboard. I didn't like that either.
Yeah, the little pointer stick.
I never liked those either.
Now, I will say, back in the day, a trackball was cool when you did, like, Doom multiplayer, because you could, like, take it and, like, push it forward real fast, like those golf games, and you would, like, run 100,000 miles an hour down the hall.
Or spin it sideways, and you could start turning in circles.
Yep.
I do remember playing Doom on a trackball. A trackball and a joystick.
Oh, goodness.
I was at somebody's house, one of my parents' friends. They had this computer. We didn't have one at the time. That's how old this was. And they had Doom. I might have been even Doom 2 or something that we were playing. And they had like a trackpad and a joystick. And I was like, what am I doing?
I don't know what's going on.
It's like the trackpad was moving and the joystick was aiming. And I'm like, needless to say, I wasn't very good at it.
Yeah. Thank goodness the trackball lost out.
I actually know somebody that still has one. And still uses it.
You should, like, hide it.
Probably has...
Just hide it from
Probably him. Has to have one of those USB to PS2 adapters or something, or vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
PS2 to USB. Those were a little bit more harder to come by.
Well, hold on. I'm reading through some of the more of an Ars Technica article right now about the server update. Sorry to jump around, but this caught my attention. It says, overall, the new policy isn't tremendously surprising. Just has to be done with the desktop operating system. Microsoft wants to be able to push new features out to Windows Server users, such as subsystem for Linux support. So, is that telling me subsystem for Linux support is going to come to as a supported feature in Server?
That's going to be great.
That's interesting.
So you're going to run all of your Linux servers underneath your Microsoft, well, on top of your Windows servers?
Well, I mean, if you're doing containers, can do all of them then. It's an interesting. I didn't realize they were going to be pushing the subsystem to Linux to the server market.
That's a very interesting thing.
Yeah, because that's actually Canonical supported. I mean, that's straight up right now Ubuntu 16.04.
That's great. I haven't actually got to play with that yet. I need to install that on something so I can actually see how all that works.
Sadly, I do have it installed, but what it gets pigeonholed into is my SSH client.
Well, that's all you can really do
because,
to it.
Because PuTTY sucks. And sorry, PuTTY developers, it does. It's time to change it.
It's like PuTTY will work great after you go in and change the 15 settings that you need to change to actually make it to work right.
Well, the thing I don't like about PuTTY is when I open it, I have to use a mouse. I don't want to click. I want to use my keyboard. I'm going to a secure shell. Why I got to grab my mouse?
And why does right click paste? I don't get it. Why does right click paste by default?
That is dangerous. I have really borked a switch before with that. And of course, I borked a switch up earlier because I fat fingered 24 instead of 42 and just applied a config to all the other ports.
Well, I shut down uplink ports all the time, so.
It's one of those, you get typing so fast, you just don't pay attention. I was like, I see a 2 and a 4. That's got to be right.
So I'm assuming that this new bringing the upgrade cycles, like from Windows 10 to Windows Server, I'm assuming that's a good thing, right?
I see it being a good thing as long as they let those LTSC branches exist with security updates.
I think at this point they have to. I mean, because they know they just can't cut everybody off. I think they're going to eventually, because I think what they're trying to do is I think they're trying to avoid problems like they had with this ransomware thing, where they want people to consistently stay up to date, and the people that are not running their updates, they're trying to avoid that, is what I think's happening.
Yeah. Well, I know I keep going back to this article and seeing something new I didn't see before. Now I see something else. All right. So I'm just going to read straight from the article. Ars Technica is awesome. If you've never been to the site, go there. Okay, it says, the server policy does have one difference from the desktop operating system. For desktop Windows, everyone is on the semi-annual channel except software assurance customers. They get access to the Windows 10 LTSP builds. On server, the reverse will be true. Only software assurance customers will be able to use the semi-annual channels. So there's your answer.
Well, that's good.
So it looks like everybody is going to be on the slow release unless they have software assurance.
That's an interesting approach to doing it that way as opposed to doing it to the desktop way.
I think it leads a lot into how you were saying they should do the subscription model.
I think that's, yeah, to me that's, this would be more, this is more of a selling point to that as opposed to the other way around as far as keeping mm-hmm. everybody secure. Because if their main focus was keeping everybody secure like I was thinking, then they wouldn't do it to just the subscription people. They would do it to the people like me who just bought my data center license and are using just that, because I don't have the software assurance on my server licenses.
So it sounds like they're going to force me to get software assurance to play with Subsystem for Linux.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. I shouldn't be playing with stuff on the servers anyway.
Well, that's what we have the lab environments for, right?
Oh yeah. In fact, I got everything. All my servers moved out now. So in my rack, well, actually out of the rack now, sitting on the floor, are 5 servers. 3 of them have 48 gig of RAM each. 2 of them have 32.
There you go. There's your nice little play environment.
I know. I'm kind of excited about that.
But yeah, that's, to me, yeah, this is kind of a selling point for people to get on the software assurance thing.
So, now I got another question. Plug your ears, Microsoft. You don't need to hear this. So, is it going to work the same way Windows 10 does, unactivated, where it just continues working but doesn't let you change personalization settings?
But like you were saying, they're not going to let you change personalization settings. But with Core and Nano, I mean, with it being just a PowerShell, there are no personalization settings.
Hmm. Well, I mean, they already offer a 90-day trial on all their stuff, and if you reset the trial, it kind of lets you keep going. But
maybe they'll make their trial. What did they say? It's every 6 months. Every 6 months, maybe they'll make their trial every 6 months. A 6 month trial now, and so you just continually get the trials.
Which I guess isn't really breaking a EULA, right?
But at this point, are they really concerned with making money on their operating systems?
I don't think so. And in fact, I read an interesting article the other day. I wish I would have bookmarked it so I could put it in the show notes. If I find it before you post it out, I'll send it to you, which showed Microsoft Azure overtaking Amazon Web Service.
That's
as cloud provider.
Well, and actually Amazon just became a customer of Azure with the purchase of Whole Foods. Mm-hmm. So, I mean...
Yeah. It shows that Nutella is... Not the hazelnut spread, but the Microsoft CEO is really doing things in the right direction now. He's really got his customer base set.
There's our show title. Not the hazelnut spread. But I think I even kind of noticed that, like, right when he first came in. I think there was a whole bunch of articles saying that, hey, this is what we're going to do. I mean, they're moving to the service, software as a service platform. I mean, I was at a conference one time last year, and Microsoft was actually there, and basically the whole session was about the Windows 10 cycle as far as upgrades and stuff like that. And it was, it was a packed house because everybody was so concerned as far as like, hey, how are we handling these updates? And I think that's when I found out about the long-term service. Well, at the time it was Branch. I guess it'll be Channel now. Or maybe it'll be...
It may be something different next week anyway.
It might be servicing Branch for the client OS and maybe Channel for the server OS.
Makes sense.
But, I mean, isn't Channel what Linux calls?
Well, Ubuntu is LTS, long-term servicing.
Oh, they don't even have the end part.
Nah, they're cool enough for three characters.
Just wondering if they were trying to be more Linux-like when they with their naming or whatever.
Well, I mean, they are aligned with Canonical now.
I mean, and Canonical is part of their secure boot, so.
Yes, and Canonical actually pays for Microsoft to sign their kernels.
I wonder if all that was put into effect because they knew that Linux was coming as a subsystem of Windows.
It may be, and oh man, I think it still blows my mind the fact that I run Bash on Linux on Windows on my desktop.
I really hope though that kind of comes to the long-term servicing channel on Windows Server eventually.
Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of people that don't like to use Linux in our sector because they're afraid of the command line and those kind of things, and I think this would let them dip their toes in that infrastructure without having to dive all out into it.
Yeah, and I used to be one of those people. I've kind of braved, and one of the real reasons, not only that I have you as a resource, but it seems that documentation is getting better for things online, getting a lot better, as opposed to just read the manual that you used to get. And part of the problem why everybody was so scared of it was because nobody knew how to do it. Because I guess in our area, Linux wasn't a big thing. Now, I talked to a guy at Home Depot that's been running Linux since it came out, and that's what he's done at his house for forever, is he's always run Linux. He's never run Windows. He's always done Linux. And it was just weird. The guy that's working on my lawnmower at Home Depot was talking to me about Linux or whatever. I guess the conversation came up because I brought my mower in and I was wearing my work badge or whatever, and he saw that I was in the network admin for the school district, and so we just kind of got to talking. And I just find it really neat that it's like you find those off-the-wall people, just out of nowhere, it's like, hey, this guy, he runs Linux, but he also works on lawnmowers. That's kind of weird. But that was kind of the thing. It's like, unless you were really self-taught, I mean, you really weren't offered, like, Linux stuff in college or whatever. And since I graduated from the school that I graduated at, this little community college here in Orange, they've asked me to be on, like, the advisory board for when it comes to, like, deciding curriculum or whatever. And that was, like, the first thing I talked about was, like, hey, you need to do server OS. You need to at least give some people some... let them at least see the install process of Linux and maybe mess with it a little bit. And they're actually teaching a whole course on virtualization now because of my suggestion. And so, I mean, we know what we need because we're out here in the field doing it. And the colleges, I mean, unless they have people like us telling them what they need, they're not going to know.
And that's one of the things, and I'm actually really excited about the next school year because we have switched our campuses to a district of innovation plan, which allows for flexibility of instructors in those CTE areas. So I'm actually going to be teaching a network class next year, and we're going to have server Fridays where we'll do networking Monday through Thursday, and then Fridays we'll dig into the server space because they're so closely related now, you just can't ignore it in one class because you have to know different things. I mean, heck, let's say you're in a Cisco guy only. Well, you still need to know how to set up a TAC server on Linux in order to use some of those features.
Yeah, I mean, I was just going to say that. It's like, I mean, that's one of the first things you do is you have to have, like, your TAC server. I mean, and you could run that on Windows, I guess, if you want to. But the point is...
Nobody listen to that. You cannot run it on Windows. It does not exist.
But the point is that a lot of times with networking, there is a server piece.
Yes.
Like the Ubiquiti Wireless that we like to use, there's a server piece that you have to install a controller. I mean, just essentially the wireless controller from Cisco is essentially a server. I mean, and then like your internet filters are essentially servers that are running. And so just because you're taking networking doesn't mean you don't need to have the server stuff. I mean, like you said, the two go hand in hand. They're all just...
Oh, yeah. I mean, you still have DHCP, you still have DNS, you still have all those network services that run on servers that you need.
Exactly. And so, I mean, you got to learn how to set all that stuff up, too. And I think, and I commend you for willing to step out and teach that. I'm anxious to see how that's going to go.
Now, let's see about Christmas how much hair I have left. Because right now, I still have a whole head. And now, while it's gray now, but there is still hair there.
But I don't know if that's something that I would ever want to do, because we're trying to do the District of Innovation thing too.
Well, I mean, you're actually kind of doing the exact same thing that I did. You'll be there next then, because I was on advisory boards for Internet 2 when I was at Lamar. So we discussed the progress and whatnot of Internet 2, had the votes on how things should progress, what equipment we should use, which connections we should get where. And then, well, I went back into the K-12 space, and I guess now the natural progression is, well, I guess I got to teach now. So you'll be teaching in another year or two.
I don't want to do that. But as long as it's something I'm passionate about, it might be different. As long as they don't stick me in a history class or something.
No. Be like, well, we're going to be going over the history of Sneakernet today.
Yeah, we're going to talk about the history of the computer. But I guess we can wrap it up there. We just kind of wanted to talk about this new server updating cycle. I think it's a great idea. I'm really looking forward to it. A little disappointed that the version of Windows Server that I'm using isn't going to be a part of it. But on the flip side of that, I'm excited that in another year or so, I'm not going to have to be redoing it, because it said that mine's going to last 2 or 3 years. So I just moved to this. I don't want to do it again. So,
you know, and it will prevent those, let's say, the Windows 2003 servers that are still in existence out there from happening with Windows Server 16.
Well, you'll be happy to know I have finally shut off my last 2008 server. So yes. It was at least R2. So, I mean, it was...
Yes. At least it wasn't built on the Vista core.
Yeah, Vista was... Oh, that Vista didn't exist in my head.
That was actually... 2008 was Vista. 2008 R2 was built on the 7 core. So, yeah.
And that's why I've always preferred. I only had to do 2008 at one school for my previous job when I was essentially a consultant and a contractor. I only had to do one really 2008 install, and it was dreadful.
I think I know where that was.
Yeah, it was dreadful. In fact, I think it's still running to this day, but I think it's getting close to being discontinued.
Say, is it plugged into a stack of ProCurve switches with Cat7 cabling?
Probably.
So I think I know where you're at.
That's probably exactly where it's at. But that's our show this week. Like always, if you have any questions or feedback for anything we've discussed, you can reach out to us on Twitter. Chris can be found at @Feeks, and I'm @TwistOfMatt. You can contact the show account at EducatingTech. Send us an email to educatingtech@gmail.com. For more episodes, visit educatingtech.net, where you can find links to subscribe or all of our other episodes. But thanks for listening, and we're going to try to avoid a hurricane tomorrow and Thursday, so we'll see how that goes. But other than that,
oh, yeah.
Have a good weekend, Chris.
Have a good weekend, Matt.